Ali, let me introduce Patrick, who is a documentary photographer and reader in photojournalism at the University of the Arts in London. He's been photographing in Spiti, a district of the Indian state of Himachal Pradesh, since 1993, and his work has been published and exhibited widely, including at the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford, where an exhibition related to the project, which we'll hear about today, is running until early July this year. There's some information about that I've printed out on the table up front. His beautiful book, entitled Spiti, The Forgotten Valley, was published in 2000 and has a dedication by the late photographer Henri Cartier-Bresson, who set up Magnum along with David Seymour, Shin, and Robert Capa. Disciples of a Crazy Saint is funded by a grant from the Arts and Humanities Research Council, which at least this week still exists. So we'll to the end of the lecture, things may have changed. And we're delighted to have Patrick here. So thank you for coming to speak to us, and over to you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for coming. Hello, relatives. Is that true? I'm going to be talking as Mark says. I'd like to thank Mark for inviting me to come and speak here. And I'd also like to thank Sarah, who advised me at the beginning of this project. And neither of them can be held responsible for anything I say during this lecture. But I'm going to be talking about Spiti, which Mark has explained is the valley of the river Spiti in North India, right on the border of Tibet. Spiti is the valley of the river Spiti and its tributaries, and one of the main tributaries is the river Pin, and I'll be talking about Pin Valley. Sometimes I'll probably talk about Spiti and Pin as if they're the same thing. Spiti is the larger area. Pin Valley is one of the kind of smaller areas within Spiti. And I'm going to be talking about a group of people called Buchen or Puchen, who are lay religious practitioners, they're performers of rituals, they're actors, storytellers, and entertainers. Buchen is a Tibetan word because these people are from a Tibetan area of India. They're right on the Tibetan border, they're kind of right on the western edge of Tibet, close to but not, but separate from Ladakh, although you can walk from Spiti into Ladakh. So they're a culturally Tibetan group. Buchen can be translated as two words, Bu meaning son or child, Chen meaning large or great, sometimes translated as great sons, also can be translated as disciples. And they're disciples of a figure called Tangtong Gyalpo, a crazy saint and a real historical figure from the 14th and 15th century in Tibet, famous for a lot of things, including his engineering projects, building bridges in Tibet. He's reputed to have lived to the age of 125. And if you book a train, which I'm doing at the moment, if you try and book a train in India online, you have to fill in your name and your details and your age. And the age goes up to 125. Whether there's a connection there, I'm not quite sure. Supposed to have lived to the age of 125. There are fantastic stories of Tangtong Gyalpo, supposed to have stayed inside his mother's womb for 30 or 40 years, 50 years, until he was an old man, was born as an old, bearded, and very wise old man, spending years meditating in his mother's womb. This is a photograph. This is a photograph I identified in the British Library about a year ago. It's from a recent donation to the British Library from the Coldstream family. John Coldstream was a settlement officer in Kulu, and photographed between 1910 and 1913. And in this photograph you see, and this is from an album entitled Spiti, and it's one of the few pictures of people in that album, they're mainly landscapes. But you can see in this photograph a kind of wide, treeless, mountainous landscape, kind of flat grassy field, a group of five people walking in a circle, a stone wall with an audience behind it, a slab of stone here resting on rocks and a boulder in front of it. And out of focus in this frame, you can see it better in other images, a background of cloth and a couple of tankers and a square box supporting a statue. And the statue is of this figure, Tangtong Gyalpo, and notes that he's got a photograph around his neck. And hair piled on top of his head. There are four photographs in the album. This is the actual moment of breaking the stone. This is a ritual which I recognized immediately when I saw these photographs, because I've seen it several times before. It's called The Ceremony of Breaking the Stone. And it was documented very very thoroughly by a Tibetologist called Georges de Rurik in a publication in 1932. And it's a kind of exorcism ritual, which involves the head puchen, these guys with kind of with hats, summoning demons and entrapping these demons in a large block of stone, which is often decorated with figures, of demonic figures, sometimes drawn on with ash these days, sometimes they paste on photocopies, which is then laid on a man's belly and smashed with a rock. And if you look carefully, you can see a pair of feet here, so there's a guy underneath here. They're now, if you can see a stone breaking now, they're very, very careful to make sure his head is covered. They're health and safety conscious. Push more stone in here. But this is the moment in which the stone will be smashed and the demon is vanquished. And you can see, you know, a couple of tankers here, some symbols, the neck of a musical instrument. And to me, what is immediately obvious is that it's very, very similar to contemporary performances. The costumes, the movements of the performers, the paraphernalia all seem to be the same. The major difference immediately to me is the length of the hair. A couple of the very old Puchen and Spiti still wear their hair long, but it's kind of braided and tied behind them. Nobody has hair of the kind of length and thickness of these dresses. Puchen perform in usually in groups of 3 to 5 people, one meni, which means grandfather, which is the head Puchen, and maybe 3 others. They are tantric practitioners. So the head Puchen spend several months, 3-6 months, maybe a year, in retreat under training from the local monastery to learn the tantric practices which allow them to, you know, summon demons and break the stone and dance on stored tips. And so they go through complicated training of, you know, visualization techniques. And this power to do this, which comes through this training, means that the head puchen in particular are both respected and quite, and in some cases, quite feared. But it's not really the age of the photographs that really excites me. You know, they're probably the first photographs ever taken of the puchen. They're the first ones I know about. What really excites me is the quality of the images, and particularly this one of Lugzi. Lugzi is the shepherd who plays a particular... is part of the kind of stone-breaking performance. And I've seen stone-breaking several times, and what Lugzi has done, he's really captured the character of this figure. He's captured his stroppiness. He's barefoot, he's ragged, he's confronting the camera, he's breathing out sampa, white barley flour, like dragon's breath. He's got a fist clenched with another handful of flour. In contemporary performances, Lugzi arrives off stage while this ritual is taking place and basically mimics the head puchen's utterances, spicing them up with obscenities and gibberish and bits of Hindi, apparently making a complete mockery of the whole ritual. And he then amuses the audience with the crudity of his language and behavior, swearing, miming sexual acts, pretending to... Sorry, there are children in the audience, but they are relatives. Sorry, Anna and Tessa, this is your uncle. This is what it's like. Miming sexual acts, pretending to defecate on stage and then wafting the stench off at the audience. And though, although he flouts the kind of authority of the head puchen, eventually he sort of submits to his authority and is subdued. Interestingly, Lugzi is not part of the text for the stone-breaking performance. It's not part of the text of the stone-breaking performance. And when you talk to Puchen about it, they say, oh, this is just a bit of entertainment. You know, what's really important is the text and the ritual itself. This is just a bit of entertainment. You know, consequently unimportant. This is rather interesting because it's very similar to some of the interludes that take place in the dramatic performances they do. They do a local, I don't use the term Ache Lamo, but they perform plays, which are a kind of localized, maybe regionalized version of the Tibetan opera, Ache Lamo. And these performances offer a kind of uninhibited space, a transgressive space for improvised banter, for uninhibited speech, for earthy humour. And even the most harrowing play has the potential for having these comedic interludes. So greed and jealousy and vanity and stupidity and cowardice and lust, all the kind of negative aspects of humanity are sort of performed and portrayed and offered up for ridicule. But within these traditional performances, the Luxis, who have to be very fast-talking and fast-thinking, offer this kind of improvised rants, and they will talk about the impinging modern world. So they'll talk about how fantastic it is to have mobile telephones. They'll say, you know, before mobile telephones, we'd all have to go to the village oracle, and he'd have to go into trance in order to speak to the village deity. Now we can just phone them up. It's fantastic. And they say things like, they talk about these kind of strange four-legged humans that arrive in the summer, which is a reference to Western trekkers using trekking poles. And they talk about foreigners kissing in public, which they find absolutely hilarious. And they talk especially about sex. Nevertheless, the main kind of thrust of these performances is conservative. The whole idea of these performances is to bring the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, to the villagers through the medium of entertainment. So they see this as a sort of vehicle through which to spread religion to the local community. As soon as I saw these photographs, I knew that I wanted to take them back to Spiti. I knew that I wanted to visually repatriate them, to use Anthro speak, to take them back and to show them particularly to this guy, Sangha Getup. I just want to see if I can open this up. I wanted to show them to Sangha Getup, who I'd photographed in Lalong in 2004. This is Sangha Getup here. And when I put the two pictures side by side, I just think it's extraordinary how similar those two postures are. They're both confrontational poses. They're both standing with one kind of knee bent, hands on hips, looking at the camera. So note the similarities. The audience in the background are both also amused by this confrontation. So note the similarities, try not to note how much better Coldstream's picture is than mine. The last time I met Sangha Getup, I'd taken him a whole bunch of photographs, and I went and visited him a day later, and he said, "I'd like to speak to you about your photographs." And I said, "That's great, tell me, what do you think of my photographs?" He says, "Your photographs are so bad," he says, "they're so awful, that after you've left the room, people tear them up and they put them in the fire." I was taught photography through a process of rather robust criticism, but this is quite a new territory for me. Let me go back. I previously visited Spiti. I'm trying to get the rest of my notes. I'm not quite sure how I do this. My notes have slightly disappeared. Okay. Okay, I'm going to have to wing it. It's all right. I previously visited Spiti several times in winter, and what I've been doing is photographing the Puchen, photographing them on tour. They do their tours in the winter. They do the stone breaking itself whenever it's commissioned. So if anybody wants to commission it, they will do that. Now, increasingly, that's done for sort of tourists, trekking groups, visiting anthropologists, filmmakers, journalists, photographers. But it's usually historically associated with kind of subjugating illnesses or when buildings are being started, and which is to do with the kind of the history of the stone breaking in Tangtong Gyalpo in the 15th century. But I've been photographing the Buchen, I've been photographing their winter performances, I've been photographing the behind the scenes preparations, their relationship with their audiences, trying to build up a kind of intimate but affectionate documentation of their theatre. But quite clearly, the Buchen have problems with this way of photographing them. And this project really is about going back to Spiti and trying to understand some of the problems and trying to find a way of making a documentation that I would see as being a kind of, you know, valid documentation for an outside audience, but the Buchen might regard as being an acceptable form of photography for them. So I asked Sangha to tell me what the difference between a good photograph and a bad photograph was. And he said basically the good photographs are static colour photographs of people dressed in their best clothing and facing the camera. and that bad photographs are unposed. They're black and white photographs that people have people caught off guard in movement, freezing facial expressions and gestures. So we've got completely opposed views on the value of photography. The value of my images, the idea of documentation, the potential of reportage photographs as a sort of documentary objects with some sort of historical value. I've got an established methodology of working. I build up a kind of reportage on a project, photographing kind of around the edges of events, very rarely interfering or posing or setting things up, seeking, you know, brief revelatory moments, moments where, you know, things come together that are expressive, trying to get under the skin of events, looking for emotional as well as descriptive qualities, trying to photograph the feeling of an event or a performance as much as what it looks like. And this is not an orderly process of kind of gathering clearly defined nuggets of information. It's a very uncontrolled, rather randomized process. This is the nature of documentary photography, gathering half-seen and often half-understood details. This is a photograph of the mother of Drukpa Kunle, another and very famous crazy saint. And Drukpa Kunle attempts to seduce his own mother twice, and then finally she converts to Buddhism. She's an unbeliever before that point. So I'm photographing I'm turning up, I'm getting permission from the Bhujan to negotiating access to these events. I'm traveling with them, I'm touring with them, spending, you know, maybe a couple of weeks going from village to village, you know, sharing their, you know, their households and eating with them, etc., etc. Trying to put together a body of work that captures the overall variety of their activities, their rituals, their performances. This is a photograph of a performance of Nyala, hell. What happens, and this is the Lord of Death here, and these figures with yak hair wigs are the Shenpa, the servants of the Lord of Death. And what they do is they drag a whole bunch of actors or occasionally villagers in front of this tribunal where there's a scale and there's a set of kind of black and white barley seeds, and their event, and the kind of details of their lives are read out and the scales are weighed. And what you can see here also is you can see the box with the statue of Tenpo Nyalpo and a tanka. Lots of women, because the audiences are mainly female, which is very interesting because, you know, quite a lot of these performances are very jokey and quite risque. And huge piles of bowls of sampa, which are kind of offerings, but are actually a kind of payment, a kind of indirect payment to the Bhujan. So what happens in Nyala, a whole bunch of people are dragged out, and if they're judged positively, they're freed. If they're judged negatively, they're tortured, and they're tortured with hot or cold water. What happens in the performance is that one individual person is chosen to be the victim of this performance and gets hot water or cold water thrown at him. What actually happens in the performance is after this happens two or three times, the villagers intervene and prevent him, the servants of the Lord of Death, getting anywhere near him. So by the end of that performance, he was sitting in the bed where he's tortured, wearing a duvet jacket, smoking a fag with a bottle of whiskey, sort of, you know, giving the spitting equivalent of V signs to the Shenpa. There's a lot of kind of humour, a lot of audience participation in these events. So what I'm trying to do is to capture things like the humour and the interaction with the local community. Bhujan are very honoured guests when they're travelling within their own community. And the sort of dancing, the singing, the praying, the partying, and the joking with the women who look after them is very much part of their role as specialist religious performers. It's not just some kind of separate social aspect. This is part of their whole role. So I'm looking for the overall feel and flavour of the Bhujan role, not cataloguing performances and rituals in ethnographic detail. What I love about the Bhujan is the kind of the intimacy of their connection with their audiences. They perform outside in midwinter, you know, February time, in an animal pen, which they've swept clean of dung and ice in the freezing cold, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, temperatures are really plunging. It's 10 degrees below sometimes. But I love this kind of slapstick and the absurd humour, but also the kind of prayer and deep emotion in these events. So I'm looking to capture the sort of potent mix of intimacy and affection. but also the religious qualities. So at this point, Bhutan, when they go and spend, when they're on tour and they're in a village, they will spend, you know, a week, maybe a month in one village, and they'll go from every household, fed by a different household every day. They're honoured guests, and they will sit and they will sing and they will pray and they'll perform within the household. So they do two or three prayers around lunchtime, and this is a Mika prayer, which halfway through the Bhutan start clapping, and it's basically a prayer to drive away Mika, which is basically a kind of, you know, bad gossip. And so they generally have a kind of beneficial kind of role to do with sort of health and exercising demons, driving away bad gossip, etc., etc. I've chosen to work in black and white, partly to sort of distance myself from the kind of romantic, colourful vision of Tibet, which sort of dominates most documentation of things Tibetan. But my sense of a visual documentation of a body of still photographs, numerous fragments of captured time that can be interpreted as some sort of representation of a version of reality, seems to be completely alien to the Bhutan. So this project is about returning to Spiti with my archive of work and historical work to try and kind of talk about and negotiate another way of practice. So the questions I'm asking really is whether or not still photography can be used to document the Bhutan without it being demeaning to them. Can it deal with and capture their humour and the sexuality of their performances without undermining the sacred nature of their and the spiritual message of their plays? And can I make an intelligent and culturally sensitive photographic document that has meaning to outsiders and yet upholds their status, the Bhutan status, as serious religious practitioners? And if so, what would it look like? I mean, Bhutan and most people in Spiti have photographs. The most common photographs are, you know, in their prayer rooms. They have photographs of the Dalai Lama and other religious leaders. But they also have photographs which are displayed on walls or occasionally in albums. And these are usually individual likenesses, ennobled and celebratory. They're always formal. They're always looking at camera. This is the language they use. And I wonder whether this language has basically, because photography's been in Spiti since the 1860s, because Samuel Bourne was there in 1863 or something like that. But people haven't actually owned cameras. They haven't actually had their own equipment. Their access to photography has been pretty minimal in that sense. So that the photographs they have are taken in studios, often outside the valley, and they are basically using a language which comes out of Indian studio photography, and I guess mimicking the kind of celebratory portraits that of religious leaders like this. And photographs in this situation are kind of devotional objects, so that if you hand somebody a photograph of the Dalai Lama or an equivalent Rinpoche, they will touch it to their forehead. You know, these are kind of objects of devotion. They have an intimate and embodied relationship with these images. So I went back to Spiti in 2010 with a grant from the AHRC and with project partnership from the Pitt Rivers Museum, carrying a laptop, piles of loose prints, in order to show this work, my existing archive and historical material. So I printed out copies of the Coldstream pictures, series of Coldstream pictures. And I started showing them to people, and I showed them there was a big festival and teaching taking place in the big Gompa in Pin Valley, and I showed them at that event. And whenever I did that, I would just get a huge crowd of people crowding around, looking at this stuff, commenting on it. Very often they would jokingly steal the pictures, you know, rather ostentatiously put it under their jackets. And a lot of people asked me for photographs. They want photographs. They particularly want these pictures. They didn't ask me for my photographs. They asked me for the historical photographs. So very clearly they want photographs. And in fact, they want my photographs. They just don't want the photographs I've been giving them. I show them these two pictures, which are taken from the book called Himalayan Shuttlecock, taken by Hans Kopp, who was somebody who was imprisoned along with people like Heinrich Harrer and Peter Aufschneider. He was imprisoned by the British in the Second World War and escaped. And in his book, Himalayan Shuttlecock, there are two pictures of Putin taken in Kinnoor, I think. Four people I show them to identify Mehmet Dalcoz from Sud, including Mehmet Dalcoz's son, who wants a photograph. And very interestingly for me, several people suggest that this, which I think of, I've always thought of as being a slightly set up, slightly artificial photograph because of the kind of proximity. I've never seen Putin line up and skewer themselves together. I've seen them do it individually, I've never seen it together. I wondered whether it had been sort of slightly set up, which kind of underlined the way I read the picture. It kind of, you know, affected my sense of it as being a documentary or whatever. People in Spiti read it completely differently. They said, several people said, oh, this is just the same guy three times. This is just a montage. It's the same person three times. Which had never, ever occurred to me. So Putin, they've got a completely different categories on which they bestow values on photographs. They haven't absorbed the kind of realist documentary aesthetic, which is the heart of, you know, my practice. They don't read photographs as unmediated slices of life, but they do embrace manipulated imagery within their concept of photography, unquestioningly. When I show them this, the Gulfstream pictures, I say, you know, this is a 100-year-old photograph of Spiti, of a stone breaking in Spiti. And the Bhutians just contradict me. They say, no, it's not Spiti, it's Ladakh. It must be Ladakh, it's probably the Changtang. Maybe it's even Tibet. It's definitely not Spiti. This happens repeatedly. And eventually, a Bhutian household, and the head Bhutian has just told me exactly the same thing, and the prints are being handed around the room. And a young woman, who I think is his daughter, says something in the corner of the room. And I say, what did she just say? And she says, this looks like Tampi Goma. And what she's saying is that this little village over here, that she's 3 houses over here, looks like the village of Tampi Goma. And we go outside and walk down the hill, my helper and translator and I, and sure enough, we can see exactly the same geological formation there. The village is now kind of expanded substantially. But it's definitely in Spiti. So we walk down to the river and we find the exact position that Coldstream stood in. It's a field, it's on the banks of the River Pin between Kungri and Sealing. I think it's very interesting because the older villagers, the older Putin don't seem to read it and the younger villagers do. I show this again to several young people in different locations and they just say, yes, that's Tangti Goma. We can recognize Tangti Goma. So the older Putin don't recognize it. And they can't, the photograph is 100 years old. It's too old for anybody to recognize any faces. You know, it's too far gone, but they all try. They all sort of say, well, maybe that could be Chetan Dorje, who died 25 years ago. And I wonder whether the difficulty they have with recognizing this image and locating this image is something to do with their inability to sort of recognize the faces, to recognize the faces and put those faces into a kind of, place the performers into the context of lineages and household and villages, which is what they do with the pictures I show them. But they also point out that it doesn't look right. The costumes look different. The head Bhutan aren't wearing the kind of the conch shell kind of waistcoats that Bhutan normally wear when they're doing stone breakings. They say that the headdresses, the hair's too long. The things are just wrong about it. They talk about the hats looking Ladakhi rather than Spiti. But I also wonder about how they're reading the backgrounds. Because if you look at photographs in households in Spiti, they're very often studio photographs with a completely artificial background where the foreground, the person, and the background aren't kind of related in terms of, you know, being an evidential photograph. Quite often these days they have computer-generated slabs of colour as a backdrop, or sometimes they're montaged onto a landscape, sort of mimicking the popular images of the Dalai Lama montaged above the Potala Palace. I've seen a household in Spiti where there's a head of one of the local villages montaged over the kind of holy site of Rewalsa. So basically, I feel that they're not reading background and the content as necessarily being the same thing. And the interesting thing about Spiti is that every household in Spiti pretty much has now got satellite TV, fantastically high-quality satellite TV, but they've never been really been exposed to photography apart from this kind of portrait photography, not still photography. They've never really had access to newspapers or magazines or anything where you get more than individual photographs. So they've gone from a kind of pre-photographic culture to a culture of satellite TV without ever being exposed to reading photographs the way I read photographs, groupings of pictures. So I sit down with Veris Buchan and pull out my black and white pictures and ask them to go through this and talk about them. And one by one, I get them to sort of discuss this. So this is part of the stone-breaking performance where the head Buchan is skewing his throat with a metal spike. He's been handing a pair of swords and he's about to dance on the sword tips. And what's quite interesting is, one by one, I mean, they're very articulate in their reading of their pictures. They're surprisingly positive. I mean, they do say that black and white is a bit depressing compared to colour. They prefer it in colour. But actually, they say, you know, when they look at it, they say, you know, we like this. What's great about this is you can see all the detail. You actually see the detail of his spiking his throat. That's really good. This one, they say, this one's good too. You can see that Lugsy is singing. And Lugsy, when he arrives at the stone breaking, you know, he's off stage and he calls out and he shouts, "Can you wake your dad up, please?" he's singing. You can see that he's singing. It's a kind of particular moment. So they like this. And they're very keen to sort of name the performers and the group and the village. So they say, you know, this is Pema Nyangel from Sagnam. He's the Ompa with Chetan Dorje's group. This is Rigzin from Sagnam. What they like about it is he's identifiable. You can see his face and you can see that he's reading the text. What I like about it is that you can see that it's a photocopied text, which is kind of the new technology. And you can see just the kind of background details of the donkey and the goat walking past. This is Mehmet Sering. They like it because it's the nearest thing I've taken to a formal portrait. Mehmet Sering is a very key figure in the Spiti Buchan. The whole tradition of performing stone breakings, and performing their plays, their Lamo-like plays, their theatre died out in the late 60s, early 70s, for maybe 15 years. Nobody quite knows. And Mehmet Sering was responsible for kind of, you know, reviving this tradition. Quite why he revived it, I'm not sure, because this was well before tourism kind of came into Spiti. But he's a key figure. Other photographs they criticise. They criticise this because of the lack of sharpness, and they're particularly disturbed by the fact that somebody's head is sort of being removed from this frame. What I would call the kind of the mood and feel of the pictures is irrelevant to them. And they have real problems with this one. And I thought, this is my one of, you know, several attempts to sort of try and deal with some of the raw sexuality of Buchan performances. And the sexual quality of their plays is very strong. I thought, I'm not somebody who believes in the kind of universal language of photography at all, but I did feel that this image would be, you know, fairly unmistakable. And I also was slightly worried about showing to them. But the problem I have is nothing to do with the content of the pictures. I hand them a print, and everybody I hand it to, it's a horizontal image, it's a horizontal print, everybody I hand it to turns it into a vertical, looks at it, and the angles are all wrong and peculiar, doesn't make any sense, and they kind of move on to the next one, rather bemused. When I suggest it has some kind of sexual connotations, they just tell me I've got it completely wrong. Again, with this moment, taken from performances of Drawa Zangmo. This is the parents of Drawa Zangmo embracing. They criticise the image not for its semi-nudity, but the fact that, you know, how can you understand this without the context of the story? You know, what are your photographs doing? And I realise I've made a kind of error, that I'm showing them individual loose prints and assuming that they would group these together. And because I work with photography all the time, I'm always thinking in terms of, you know, a book or a spread or some construction of still photographs. And they're reading these as individual separate photographs, none of which really come anywhere close to what they think a photograph should be. So there's a clear gap between the kinds of, you know, documentary reportage photographs I've been taking and the formal portraits that they request, they want. There's a confusion and a clash between our differing concepts of the real and the ideal, and the proper role of photography. So in conversations and discussions, we come up with the idea of shooting a series of colour portraits of the main characters from their plays. A series of portraits that might fit the Buchan idea of a good photograph, while also having a kind of documentary value to me and to an outside audience. We list the principal stories, the important characters from the stories, Drimek Kunden, Drawa Zangmo, Drukpa Kunle, other plays, and we start to photograph them as simple formal colour portraits. I suggest that they present themselves to camera in a way that they want to be seen, but they make the rather interesting point that they don't want me to photograph too much, because I photograph, you know, really, really thoroughly, and I have a kind of really, really thorough documentation. Who's going to want to come to Spiti and see their performances? Which I thought was a really interesting point. We're working with a digital camera and a laptop, which allows us to view and edit the work as it progresses. So we can check, discuss, reshoot, and continue the process. And we have a lot of fun. We gather together costumes and props. This is Nancel Ombom, and this is the daughter. There's several birthing, hysterically funny birthing scenes that take place within the plays. We choose a neutral background within the village hall and shoot the separate characters. This allows us to work without too much distraction and disturbance from onlookers. They start off kind of presenting themselves very formally. But as soon as they get into costume, they slip into character and start performing to the camera. And I photograph this, and they seem to be quite happy with this. So sometimes we're shooting static, full-length portraits. Sometimes we're shooting vignettes of scenes from the plays. And sometimes we're shooting characters in role. They seem really pleased with the results of these sessions. We edit them, we discuss the photographs, what works and what does not work, and the project seems to be kind of moving forward. And at the end of the 2 days of shooting these photographs, I discuss with them, you know, what they would like for themselves. And they say, yes, we definitely want prints from these sessions. They even specify the sizes. But it's the portraits in their best clothing. They don't want the portraits in roll. It's the formal portraits out of costume that they want. These are the ones. You know, we want them this size, you know, individual group shots. This is rather confusing and rather disappointing in terms of finding a sort of collaborative solution to documenting the Poochum and producing an outcome in which they can feel some sort of ownership. It doesn't seem like we've progressed at all. These portraits are very static, very respectful of people presenting themselves to camera looking their best. Perhaps they can be described as honorific, formal manifestations of ennobled social identity. And honor and respect are fundamental elements in daily social interaction in Spiti. It's marked very obviously through language, through honorific and humilific forms of language, marked out in the positions that people occupy or offered within social spaces, but also it's marked out by the music and songs that played by the lower caste musicians. And if these portraits are a kind of honorific form, then maybe my reportage photographs are a kind of insult, like addressing somebody in the wrong language, or addressing them as if they were lower caste, or sitting in a completely inappropriate part of the room. But however, my anxiety that the very idea of using the secular medium of documentary photography to document and record their religious performances might be deemed utterly inappropriate seems to be contradicted by the Buchan desire to own the Coldstream and the Kop pictures, which I feel are similar in many ways to the photographs I've been taking. They seem to regard the very old photographs as being part of their kind of visual history, but my reportage photographs are maybe too recent to be part of their visual history and too informal to fulfill the useful function of domestic display, which is what they want out of me, really. So my pictures are contemporary photographs of recognisable people that don't fit into the respectful mode of formal portraiture. I also, when I go back to look at this, I notice that, particularly in this frame, Pilstrom's got rather distinctive looking tankers in the background. And I wondered whether we could locate these. So we go and have a look around and ask in the various different Pilstrom households to see if we can find these tankers. And I never really paid that much attention to the tankers when I'd seen the performances before, because the tankers are often quite crude and incredibly battered. And there should be a tanker, and the tankers they use are kind of narrative tankers which explain the story that's being performed. And they don't necessarily use the correct tanker in performances, so I'd never really looked at these. But I start looking around and I discover there are various tankers held in active and inactive Pilstrom households. And I document some of these. This is a very fine tanker of the story of Mansell Ombon, and it was bought in Purang in western Tibet by the father of the current owner of the tanker. And he remembers his father being an active Pilstrom and travelling, going away for maybe 6 months of the year, travelling. Very hard life, very, very poor, father away for long periods of time. In fact, when I was in Purang last year, they still remember the Spiti Pilstrom coming and doing their performances, and they remember the stone breaking and the sword dances and whatever. And these are quite different from, you know, the kind of tankers I've seen before. Sometimes they're very simple, sometimes quite crude, with sort of narrative illustrations telling episodes of the story in visual terms. So this is a story, this is an appallingly harrowing story of Mansell Ombon, who's a kind of a woman who wants to dedicate her life to kind of religious practice and to spiritual practice. And she gets married and has a child and ends up being really appallingly abused by her family. Her sister-in-law is very jealous of her and tells tales about her. One day a figure and a monkey appear. This is coming in later. And tells her about the Dharma, and she goes to see a lama and is, you know, badly beaten up by the family. She's finally killed by the family, dies, goes to, you know, to the gates of heaven, and is told that she must come back. Her life has not ended, and she comes back as this kind of ghost-like figure. But it's an absolutely appalling story. But I notice that there are details within these tankers, little details in these tankers, which are actually rather similar to some of the photographs I made. So this is from a tanker about hell, and this is a two servants of the Lord of Death keeping warm in a polythene tunnel greenhouse before they perform. And the kind of the black hair and the swords and the paintings of the body are very similar, and the torture is what they do. So I notice there's a kind of connection between some of these tanker details and some of these photographs. And I put them side by side on the computer and show them to the Pilstrom. And the Pilstrom are completely uninterested in the fact that I'm working on an exhibition for the Pitt Rivers Museum. I couldn't care less about that. But when I talk about a catalogue, there may be a catalogue, which my translator, with translators being a book, tell, they become quite interested, and they can be quite animated, and they want to know about this book, and they want to know, you know, where it's going to be produced, what's going to be inside it, whether they can have copies. And it's the first sign that they're actually interested in some aspect of my work. So I start pairing various different bits of tanker with some of the portraits. So this is a tanker of Nyala, of hell. And you can see one of these servants of the Lord of Death, dragging down figures which are kind of marked with a black rope. And there's a line of figures, let's stand on the chair here. A line of figures which is a hunter with a rifle and a bayonet, and an Amchi, a healer, and a poor woman. And you can see here a hunter, an Amchi, and a poor woman. And what you can see within the tanker is the hunter. He's got a black rope dragging him down to hell, to suffer in hell. The poor woman hasn't, so she's going to get off free because she's dedicated her life to, you know, correct spiritual practice. And the Amchi apparently has done a lot of good in his life, that he's been selling his medicine at a too high a price. So he's going to be dragged down to hell for a period of time and then be released. So this idea of kind of, you know, pairing pictures together and making a book emerges out of the process of this photography. And they talk about the book and they want to have ownership of this book. So here you have a scene from the story of Drinek Kundan, and you have the elephant. The elephant in the story is an absolutely minor figure. I don't think there is an elephant. I think in the story they refer to elephants as a sign of the kind of wealth of the kingdom that Drinek Kundan is a prince in. And the story of Drinek Kundan is that basically he's so generous that when people come to ask him for things, he gives it away. He'll give you anything you want. And so he gets taken advantage of. And finally, somebody from the neighboring kingdom and comes and asks for this blue thing, which is the wish-fulfilling gem, which is the source of all the wealth of the kingdom. And he says, yeah, you can have that. And these are the same play, different part of it. These are sort of beggars who are arriving from the neighboring kingdom to ask Drinek Kundan for things. And there's a sort of slapstick quality to their performance. And this is beggars arriving. Drinek Kundan literally gives everything away. He gives his children away to a childless couple. At some point he gives his wife away. He gives all his possessions away. He's thrown out of the kingdom and has to go and live in the forest. Comes back many years later. On the way back, you know, his father has recognized that he's a sort of deeply holy person. And he wants him to come back and to sort of come back into the kingdom. And on the way in, he's reunited with his children and with his wife. And just before he gets to the palace, he's approached by a blind man who doesn't have any eyes. So Drinek Kundan plucks his eyes out and gives them to the blind man. And this photograph is the blind man and his wife fainting at this sight. And this is, when you see the performances in Spiti, sometimes they're done as plays and they're with slapstick and they're very funny. And sometimes very rude, and they're very entertaining. But the same story is sometimes just read as a sort of purely narrated, straight from the text reading, in which case they are, you know, quite traumatic stories. And I've been in a room where people will just be sitting around weeping at this story. So the stories are performed in various different ways. It's like there's the text, which can be narrated, and then there's the plays and then their tankers. It's like three different versions of the same basic story. So the idea of making a book is providing a kind of structure that contextualizes both some of the new photographs, whether tanker details or the portraits, and some of the old black and white photographs. And it's maybe placing the sort of the work that they find challenging into a framework that they can maybe make sense of. And I think the important thing to understand is that for the Puchen and for other people in Spiti, books are something which are very value-laden. These are traditional Tibetan pecha, which are, you know, their texts. And these are kind of rare and special objects. And for the Puchen, for other specialists within Spiti and other Tibetan areas, the ownership of these represents lineage and authority and access to and control over this specialist form of knowledge. But also, you know, in modern Spiti, books represent education and schooling and the future and the potential of employment in government jobs, etc., etc. So whether they're modern books or ancient books, the idea of a book has got some sort of particular kind of value. But I think they also understand something else, is that you know, putting something into a book so that is bound together, you know, they do understand what this is, both kind of contains and constrains these photographs. So the still photographs that I was showing them are kind of confusing fragmentations of rather complicated events. Prints, loose prints are kind of material objects whose slippery nature means that they can go into contexts where perhaps they're not appropriate. But in a book, they're perhaps, you know, they're no longer loose pieces of paper, they're bound together, they're sequenced, they're captioned, they're meaning less open to differing interpretations. I also recognize that, you know, the Puchen, although they're extremely remote, in an extremely remote community, you know, they're now aware of the possibility of different audiences. They do their stone breakings. I've never seen a tourist at their winter performances because it's too bloody cold for anybody to sensibly to go to Spiti in February, but they perform their stone breakings regularly for kind of outside audiences, and they have done it outside. They did a stone breaking in Delhi for a kind of cultural event recently. And I think that, you know, they realise that a book is also a possibility as a kind of marketing tool for them, something that will take their, you know, their theatre and their culture to a wider audience. You know, this is their source of income, and they do want to continue this, and they do want to kind of expand their audiences, really. This is Lama Shakya Gyaltsen from the story of Nangso Longbum. This is an absolutely tiny detail from the story of Nangso Longbum. It's a detail that's on the tanker, it's a detail that's in the story, you know, it's a monkey. But within the Buchan performances, this becomes an extraordinary, unforgettable, and when I've seen it, a hysterically funny and obscene performance of a monkey in sackcloth with the kind of, you know, red testicles and red penis. And when I've seen it, it starts off on its knees in the audience, and a llama starts playing the kokpo, and it starts to dance, and then it starts to waggle its penis from side to side. And this is in an audience of women and children who find this absolutely hysterically funny. So lots of these performances have a kind of sort of inversion of the kind of, you know, of the kind of correct attitude to kind of religion and to llamas and to the monastic culture. They kind of portray monks within their plays as sort of, you know, randy and mumbling gibberish instead of prayer. But they're also a sort of celebration, I feel, of humanity, playfully attacking unthinking convention. But when you talk to them about these performances, they always denigrate this aspect of their performances, not just the sexuality, but the local theatre. They denigrate this stuff which is locally specific, unique, unwritten and intangible. They say what you should value, what is important is the text. This is periphery, this isn't stuff that's important. It's the story and the written text. So what I've been photographing, the stuff that excites me, and what I've been photographing, they see as being quite marginal. So perhaps my work highlights and concretizes some of the ambivalence that the Buchan themselves and the community have about these performances, because the community is changing. So I saw the monkey dance several years ago, and I made a radio program for the World Service, and the monkey danced it, you know, in its full obscene, in its full sort of obscenity. And then I saw it a few years ago, and it was being filmed specifically by a kind of group of outsiders, and the monkey appeared de-sexed. And I asked the Puchin performers after that, and they said, well, we're not quite sure whether this is appropriate for this kind of audience. And what's very interesting is you speak to the Ombas these days, and they say, well, we just have to, they're like any live comedians. They go out and they kind of gauge the audience. If they tell a really, really dirty joke and it's really sort of disapproved of, then they change their humour. So there's a sense now that the audience within Spiti itself is changing. And interestingly, it's the young people who are most disapproving. The older people are completely accepting. The older women will just join in and enjoy the performance. The young people have a problem with it. So Sangha Geta Kia sort of decided to, you know, to pose in his full glory of his monkeyhood. And I asked him, are you happy for this to be in the book? You know, and he said, yeah, absolutely. And I asked him again and again and again, you know, is this going to be something that you want your grandchildren to have? And he said, absolutely. There's no problem at all about showing this picture of the book. When I first went to, when I first brought the Coldstream pictures back to Spiti last year, I took them out in Tabo, which is one of the kind of main large villages in Spiti, a well-connected village. And somebody grabbed it on a mobile phone. It had taken 100 years for this print to come back to Spiti, and 5 minutes after I kind of got it out of the box for the first time, somebody had grabbed it on a mobile phone and pinged it to somebody else. Joining the kind of shared images of the Rinpoches, of family portraits, of pop stars and sports stars. Mobile phones have become ubiquitous in Pin. The Pin Valley, mobile phones are very, very commonplace. Now, this is nothing unusual in contemporary India. You have mobile phones everywhere. But there's actually no mast in Pin Valley, so there's no mobile signal within 2 hours of drive, 2 hours drive of this place. So mobile phones, and this is a Poochin, you know, videoing a performance and showing his fellow head Poochin the performance. Mobile phones have arrived, and they are MP3 players, and they are clocks, and they're status symbols, and more than anything, they're cameras. They're the first common camera in Spiti. I went to, this is the second day of a kind of series of teachings and cultural performances. And during the monastic ritual, I noticed monks and nuns pulling out mobile phones and photographing each other. At some point, the Rinpoche himself, who was conducting the proceedings, pulled out a Leica and was photographing the event. So mobile phones and that kind of photography have been very, very commonplace. And I think what is very interesting is that these are not the kind of posed photographs that the Poochin expect. These are, you know, kind of snapshots, the kind of grabbed, informal kind of pictures that, you know, I've been showing them and they've been having problems with. And I think this new technology offers not just access to the process of image making and editorial control, it also gives them a kind of an understanding of the basic sort of language of photography. If you think and have only ever been exposed to the kind of formal portraiture, and you think that is what a photograph looks like, then my photographs are kind of really, really challenging or insulting. But if you start using a mobile phone and you discover how the camera, however that's defined, slices up and fragments and divides the world up and cuts people's heads off and includes things and excludes things, then I think you come much closer, they'll come much closer to a kind of understanding of the basic methodology of photography. So I was concerned when I went to Spiti, I was concerned that I breached some sort of unexplained rules by photographing what I felt were public events that I'd negotiated. I thought that maybe I'd kind of taken the pictures in one particular situation and represented them in a situation where they were inappropriate. But what occurs to me, it's not actually the act of photographing or even the existence of the photographs in the wider world. It's actually taking them back to Spiti that caused the problem in the first place. You know, if I'd never taken them back, we wouldn't have had this dialogue. Poochin wants a particular kind of photograph from me, and it's not the kind of photograph that I've been taking. They've been not only disappointed, what I've been giving them has been completely useless to them. But there's also something about the status of the Poochin themselves, and I wonder whether my work has somehow highlighted and concretized some of the ambivalence about the Poochin. The Poochin are theatrical performers and are often, I mean, if you read people like Stein and others, they're often seen as being kind of rather low down in the social scale. And there is this interesting thing that within Pin especially, they're regarded as kind of guests of honor. They're revered. They're, you know, these are serious religious practitioners. However they express and perform that aspect of religion, they're seen as being real religious practitioners and very definitely honored guests. When they go outside of Spiti, they sometimes complain that people just want to see their stone breaking. So when they go to Ladakh, they just do the stone breaking, like, you know, in the nomadic community. Sometimes they will do it every day for about 3 weeks. They don't want anything else. They don't want their prayer, they don't want their music, they don't want their theater. They just want the kind of the exotic ritual. And I think that there is something kind of complicated about this. They're seen sometimes as being a kind of religious beggar, as being people who are exchanging sort of religious practice, spiritual practice, for, you know, money, for barley, and historically for old clothes. So they're, in a sense, they're trading the spiritual for the material. And I wonder whether some aspect of my photography has sort of amplified or triggered off that sense of their ambivalence. Okay, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Patrick. that's a wonderful talk, and it's raised so many questions. Perhaps I can kick off with a couple, and then open it up for you to field other questions from the audience. I'm thinking back to this point you raised at the beginning about why the early photographs in black and white were accepted, and yours were not. And I wonder whether it's something to do with what my son said to me recently. He said, "Daddy, were you born in the old times when everything was black and white?" And I said, "No, I wasn't, but Grandma was." And the point being that, of course, by definition, the photos that you brought back, repatriated, were going to be black and white. But how could you have, you know, how could you have brought something back that was so old-looking but was obviously made modern? And I suppose out of that comes a question, which is, you said early on again, the present images of Tibet are so dominated by romantic, you know, and sort of colourful, resplendent pictures of people and place. But is there not something equally romantic, but differently romantic, about you photographing
about black and white?
And after that then, could you not photograph in colour digitally, but then produce black and white derivatives yourself, and colour the same image, and you would just be with one Photoshop autocorrect?
Well, that's a whole series of questions. Yes, you could. I mean, when I first started photographing, I wasn't working digitally. And I started photographing in colour because it seemed like, you know, the obvious thing to do. And I started in 1993 when I first went to Sputi. I photographed in colour and I came back with a lot of colour film and a little bit of black and white film. And I discovered two things, really, which is that the photographs that I was making in black and white were more rich and intimate, but also it was very difficult to deal with colour. I found that, you know, I was often photographing in extremely low light, and it was more straightforward without flash. It was more straightforward to deal with in black and white. But also, sometimes you go into houses in Spiti and the interior walls are kind of, you know, dark blue or dark green, and you've got so much colour information that it often seems to kind of override, you know, what the photograph is about in my turn. So I found that, but also the kind of the extremes of contrast, you then go outside and it's kind of, you know, blindingly, you know, snow and direct sunshine or whatever. So I found colour slightly, you know, back in 93, slightly complicated to deal with, and black and white more manageable. And I also found that, you know, I found the language of working with black and white was more where I came from, I guess. But I also found that, you know, there's just something about the amount of colour and how you read it that I found problematic. But I think the thing about the sort of historical factor, I think the second trip I made to Spiti, I came in through Delhi, and all through the streets it had something about, you know, how, you know, India at a certain point had got its independence and then, you know, had abandoned black and white from the sort of the Times newspaper or whatever. And this great sense in India that black and white is to do with the past and, you know, colour is to do with the present. So I think that is very much built into the kind of reading of things. The kind of romantic thing, one of the problems with photography is that, you know, photography does somehow or other aestheticize what's in the frame, whether it's black and white or colour. It does change things and it does change the way you feel things and look at things. I mean, I try and make strong photographs, and I also try, but I try to put groups of pictures together in such a way that I may well have pictures which look, you know, very beautiful. You know, if a landscape is extraordinary and you photograph it and the photograph looks extraordinary, that seems to me a very straight documentary process. But there's a lot of photography which is about making things much more beautiful or much more romantic or much more perfect. So I sort of, in the edit of grouping pictures together, I would try and temper pictures that are maybe very, very beautiful and perfect and lyrical and whatever, with pictures which are very definitely about harsher aspects of the society or group or subject matter I'm portraying. So that there's something in the overall edit which is clearly kind of not romanticising. I think that anybody who goes and photographs anywhere within the Tibetan world is having to deal with this whole mass of kind of ideas about Tibet, and most of those, I mean, popular ideas about Tibet, and most of those are very, very romantic ideas. And I think as soon as you start photographing things Tibetan, you walk into this kind of minefield and have to try and negotiate your way through as unscathed as possible.
Mm-hmm.
very, very interested in when cultures don't understand each other and how often that happens. So when I saw that that's what you were going to talk about, I made a beeline for here. So I guess my question is around misinterpretation, continuing to attempt to interpret people where you already know that you've already misinterpreted, or there's been a big gap in understanding in the first place. And I guess what I'm wondering is your interpretation of not hostility, if you can put it that way, but the lack of interest in the what we would call photojournalist or, you know, realistic images. Because you've interpreted it in one way, and that's the history of photography, or a history of being without still photography. But I'm wondering whether there's something else, just to throw it in, just because I like to randomize any kind of interpretation, and offer many, many multiple interpretations. Because I'm thinking about our history of images, and in the long art history of images, during the Baroque period and during Romanticism, that's when movement came into paintings. And other periods, things were very stilted and still. I don't have a reason for why that happened. I just know that that's what happened art historically. But I do put it to you that perhaps, rather than being without, or a kind of jump in modernism to postmodernism, or whatever, or the other ways of telling a story, it may be almost a fashion. Just as Baroque was a fashion after, or after the kind of more rigid way of depicting the world of the Renaissance, or after neoclassicism we had Romanticism, just perhaps more akin to actually our movements, and that there's a preference, an aesthetic preference for the still, or the stilted by our, because we're still within Romanticism visually. I'm offering that. And also the other thing I was offering that I wanted to offer you was that perhaps the different allowances in the photograph, the photograph on paper, to the mobile phone photograph, maybe the medium, I'm just wondering. Because paper, if it's associated with text, it will read differently with a different weight too. So it's just, I just wanted to chuck it in.
Well, that's more than two questions in there, but yes, I think that the second question, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think when I kind of went back to Spiti, I grew up with sort of analog photography and kind of prints and contact sheets, and have embraced, you know, digital photography. I'm showing photographs on a laptop, and I sort of slightly naively went with stuff loaded on the laptop and stuff of prints, thinking that they were somehow equivalent. And of course they're not. You know, a print is something which is a physical material object that you can pick up and you can handle, and it has got a front and a back, and you can turn it in whatever direction. And I don't know whether people, if you showed somebody with a mobile phone, if you handed your mobile phone an image of the Dalai Lama to, you know, somebody in Spiti, whether they would touch the mobile phone to their forehead, whether they have that kind of relationship. So all sorts of these kind of complicated things. But I kind of went sort of with this sort of slightly naive sense or unthinking sense that these were kind of somehow equivalent, and of course they're not. But I think the idea of, I mean, I do think that the it is, you're quite right, it's more than just not having the technology. I think that they have kind of embraced a tradition of what a photograph is. And the photographs are sometimes, you know, very formal sort of studio portraits. There's now one or maybe two places in Spiti where you can have your photograph taken, but this is relatively recent. Previously, they would have their portrait taken outside of Spiti in one of the, you know, in Shimla or Dharamsala or somewhere like that. And they go into a studio and they have a formal studio portrait. But if you look in their albums or on the walls, there's a sort of mixture of different kinds of formal portraits. And some of them you would regard as being almost a snapshot. And it's quite clearly somebody who's gone, who's a member of the family, who's gone through school and got a gone to do a teacher training course in Manali or gone and trained as a veterinary pharmacist, and they've gone out of the community. And fellow students have had access to a camera, and they've had a camera, you know, as a student. But the photographs, although they have a sort of slightly different aesthetic, they're always the same thing of standing and posing and looking at the camera. That's the kind of language that they have embraced and accepted. And I think it is to do with a sort of, you know, embracing and accepting that there is a particular way of doing things, and it is still. But it is quite interesting that in the prayer rooms, the historical photographs of the Dalai Lama and other Rinpoches and other religious figures tend to be like that. But there is now seems to be a sort of emerging kind of photographs which are much less formal photographs of these religious figures, you know, kind of court expressions. So I wonder whether that will change things, that you know, that there is a sort of sense of the idealized photograph to display is, I mean, it's not that different from, you know, the kind of school photograph. You know, if you have, you know, the photograph, I absolutely hate the photographs that we have of our kids taken at school, but we buy them every year. And they're, you know, they're kind of, they're not the children that I know, but they have a particular sort of role. And because we've done it for the other kids, we have to do it for these kids, and because we, and they come around every year, they had all this money. And I'm a photographer, why am I paying for all this stuff? But we do have them, and they do have a kind of role. But I, you know, it does occur to me that there is a question mark, because one of the Bhushans said to me, he said, we don't need you anymore, we've got mobile phones now. We don't need you photographers. But what I wonder is, you know, getting the photographs off a mobile phone is more complicated, it's possible, obviously. Printing them out and the kind of quality you will get from a phone, you know, how does this fit in with their idea of a, you know, the proper photograph? So it may be that mobile phones give them a particular kind of photography, which is the photographs they carry around on their mobile phones, which is like a kind of parallel stream of images and documentation to the way they use photographs within their households and present themselves. So it may be a kind of an addition rather than in any sense a kind of replacement to what they're doing.
Well, I was absolutely fascinated by the not only with the images but also my own story, because there are so many resonances also with other traditions. You were mentioning Ashtanga tradition in the Tibetan context. And I was quite intrigued by the fact that there had been this break that you mentioned of about 10-15 years. And I was wondering what happened when they started to reconstruct the tradition. Were the same people, the same Bhushan that were practicing before the interruption, then those who kind of revived it, and then they were basically, they knew how to do the costumes, they knew how to perform, they had the ancient librettos, or was it a new generation of people who had to do a kind of patchwork, in which case possibly ancient images, then the tankas, so the kind of bricolage, kind of pulling together all the bits and pieces was much more significant. And in that case, it would be very interesting to know historical photographs played a part in the whole operation,
I don't know. I mean, they have. What's quite interesting is the Rurik article in 1932 has got photographs in it, and it is inside, it has been brought back at some point, so somebody has brought it back. And, you know, one of the head Bhushan I know has got a sort of archive, you know, he's very interested in getting pictures to add to the archive of documentary photographs that he's got. So there is a sort of sense of a kind of keen interest in there, in their history and the history of the Bhushan, but also potentially the kind of the wider history of that kind of performance. They're unaware of why they're in Pin Valley. They kind of know there's an association with other areas of Tibet. They used to travel to other areas of Tibet, and there did used to be the association with Chungpa Rinpoche and other places where the Lama troop there always used to do a stone break in this part of their kind of performances, but they don't, you know, they don't have any rationale for why they're in Pin Valley or, you know, what their history is. Nobody could really explain why they're in Pin Valley, why they've survived and possibly not survived anywhere else. I'm not sure about when they died out. I mean, Last year was the first time I'd ever heard about this. I mean, when I, if you read about the Pooch-in, I think Rurik talks about there being something like 19 groups of Pooch-in, and Lyle in 1860 refers to, he calls them Borans, but they're obviously the same people, and I think he may mention 19 groups. When I went to and photographed the Pooch-in in 1996, there were apparently 5 groups. And it felt like, you know, potentially they were kind of dying out. Now there's about 10. So the population, you know, they kind of died out in the 60s, 70s, I don't know the exact dates. There was about 5 of them in 96. Now, you know, there's a kind of resurgence of them. And when you talk to Pooch-in about why the resurgence and why the more people doing it, because it's a very arduous process of training and it's not clearly, you know, where does the money come from? How much money did they get out of this? They will say that basically it's a kind of vocation. It's about the religious quality. It's about teaching the Dharma. It's about spreading the Dharma to the villages. It's about, you know, the great saint Tangtong Gyalpo. But then privately, when you kind of, you know, leave the Pooch-in, they will individually say to you, you know, when you come back, or, you know, if you hear of any trekkers who want to see the Pooch-in, can you make sure they come to my group? One of them has said, you know, when you come back, you must come to my group, and has made me almost kind of write that in blood, you know, that he would be the only group. So there's a very definitely a kind of sense of a kind of commercial possibilities. And they're all, as I said earlier, they're all aware of the wider world. What is strange is that they're, you know, this kind of theatre only works if you have an audience that understands it. You know, it's this kind of improvised joking. Is for a very specific local audience. I mean, even people from sort of outside the community sometimes find it a little bit difficult to follow because it's so fast. It's like alternative comedy in the UK. You have to be really attuned to follow it. So the Pooch-in are quite keen to take this to bring it to the States and Germany and Cambridge. But quite what the audience would make, I don't think they get very much out of these performances because it's so verbal. So there are problems with that. Your point about this kind of bricolage, how they put this together, I'm not really sure. I think Serenpa was actually already trained. I think he said to me that a whole number of very, very respected Pooch-in died quite quickly. And they, you know, there wasn't that kind of much call for their Pooch-in, and after several years, they realized that actually this whole tradition was threatened, that actually it might die out. But they also refer to the fact that at some point the Dalai Lama made a statement about the Pooch-in as being a very valuable part of Tibetan history. And I don't know when he made that statement, but the Dalai Lama visited and did a Kalachakra in Spiti in the early 80s, and it might possibly be something to do with that, but I'm not sure. But when you talk to the Pooch-in, why they're Pooch-in and why they go through this sort of arduous training, particularly the head Pooch-in, they say, well, it's a religious calling, but also the Dalai Lama has said that this is a special tradition that should be held onto and not die out. So that's part of their kind of explanation. Sorry.
Yes, I have one more question. Sorry. Yes.
Yeah, just following up on some of that as well. I mean, interested in what you said at the very end about the fact that they were somehow self-conscious and unsure about a transformation from a more spiritual goal to a more commercial one. I think that's what you said at the end, and that the photography sort of heightened their awareness of that process. I wanted to ask you to say a bit more about that, but also ask, hasn't it always been a form of income generation, or haven't they always made money doing it? So, I mean, is there a sense of a fundamental difference, do you think, in their minds, performing it and making money for villagers and performing it and making money from tourists, and what's that difference? And I mean, what I was thinking of as well is just what you were talking about, how they didn't want to appear in costumes for your staged photographs.
Yeah.
Right? And I mean, how there seems to be a sense of a competition of their mind, right? Photography and the performance are both already kind of competing forms of the same sort of thing. Right? Where, I mean, if they're, like you said, they didn't want you to photograph them because then you would come and see them perform. But that somehow, it's like in that process of objectification or
Yeah.
Something like that. The performance is already doing that, and the photography comes into it for it to kind of compete with those larger audiences.
I'm not sure I fully understand the second question, Sarah. Let me answer the first question first, and we'll try and come back to the same one. The first one, I probably didn't express myself all that well. I don't think, I wasn't saying that there's an ambivalence between their kind of role as sort of as religious practitioners in their commerce. I think what I was trying to say, I may well have misstated this, a kind of ambivalence between the kind of earthy, sexualized, joking part of their performance and their role as religious practitioners. Okay. Maybe the local, the new audience within Spiti doesn't really understand that actually this is a very, very long, very well-established tradition. This is part of sort of Tibetan culture, and it's kind of, it's okay and it's acceptable. Maybe they see it as being slightly kind of embarrassing or demeaning, whereas the older audience has seen this stuff from childhood, and they know what Putin performances are like, and they vary. I mean, a group may decide to do, they have a number of different plays that they perform, some of which they know extremely well, and they can just do, by heart at the drop of a hat, just need to kind of make or gather the costumes and perform the play. Other ones they know less well, and they refer back to the text. So quite often they'll be reading the text during the performances, and it's a less kind of fluid kind of performance. But there's undoubtedly a kind of ambivalence, I think, between the fact that they are undoubtedly kind of religious performances and want to be valued and respected as religious performances, and the fact that they're there's a lot of sort of joking, and there's some obscenity, and there's a lot of flirtation, and they're regarded slightly as sort of playboys, in a sense. And it's quite interesting, because somebody showed me a section of a kind of interview or text which basically recognizes the kind of affectionate relationship between the women of the village and the Putin as being, spiritually valuable, as being kind of something which is part of the Putin's way of spreading the Dharma. Nothing to be kind of regarded negatively. I think you're absolutely right. They've always made their living from their performances. They make their performances, and they're given barley and used to be given old clothes. But they seem slightly kind of touchy about the fact that they make their living. So that the barley and money from performance is always given slightly indirectly. Barley is a kind of offering you put in front of the kind of the altar with Tangtong Gyalpo, and then it's put into sacks which they collect in the springtime. And money is given sort of during certain religious performances. They come around and people put rupee notes into a plate of barley. It's not kind of given directly. And once I made a recording of some Putin performing music, and at the end of it, I gave them some money, and they said, we're not taking money for performing. You could make an offering to Tangtong Gyalpo. We are not being paid to perform music, because that is the role of the lower caste musicians in Spiti, and we are not the lower caste musicians. So they have a kind of a complicated sort of relationship with payment for their performances. But if you go to a Putin and say, will you do a stone breaking for me? They'll say yes, and they will tell you exactly, it's 6,000 rupees. So, and that is, and if you're quiet, we might negotiate it, but the sort of union rate across Pin Valley, and it's going up all the time, is 6 or 8 or 10,000, whatever it is now. So it is kind of slightly problematic, that whole thing of money and stuff like that. And your second question, I'm sure I fully understood.
Sorry, I didn't answer it very well. You said something about how they didn't want you to take too many photos because that would make people not want to come and see them.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that made me think, is there something about photography as a form of documentation or objectification, to use a fancy term, right? Which in some ways competing with their own performance, right? I mean, is photography actually are kind of outdoing them in a way by somehow augmenting?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just trying to think. I mean, it just came from what you said about that. And is that part of the problem, really, where it has to be done live. It has to be something where people actually come and see them performing it, and not a kind of second level representation or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's absolutely a kind of living, performing theatre, and that's the only way I think it really makes sense, is it has to be done in front of and with an audience. And it is quite interesting because when they do the stone breaking for visitors, so you know, if you're a trekking group or, you know, you're a serious Tibetologist or whatever, you can go and ask for this performance to be done for you. And the first time I saw it, this is how I did it. It's the only time at that point that I ever paid for anything in Spiti. And I felt a little bit kind of compromised by doing that and by paying and asking for something to be done. But actually, all stone breakings are commissioned. They don't fit into some sort of, you know, annual cycle. They're not done in the spring or after the harvest or anything. They are done after the Cham in Khumbu Gompa. But I don't know that that's necessarily been going on for long. And it's done as sort of the beginnings of sort of, you know, secondary days of cultural, local cultural and folk events. But when the Puchen do this, every time I've seen it done for villagers, paid for by villagers, on two or three occasions, and I've seen it done, paid for by me, and paid for twice by other people. And they don't do a sort of dumbed-down version of it. They do the whole performance, and when you talk to them, or pretty much the whole performance, and it's long and it's slow, and most people commission it and then get fairly bored with watching it, wish it had been a sort of half-hour, you know, highlights. But they always do the whole performance, and I've seen them do the complete performance in front of an audience of two villagers, you know, five of them doing the whole thing for 3 hours in freezing cold weather. So they take that part of it very, very seriously. What they say is that it doesn't actually matter whether it's for a trekking group, you know, whether the people who understand it, who are witnessing and paying for it, actually understand it, because the performance and the ritual has power and it has significance, and it's basically kind of modifying the world around us. It's taking these negative forces which are around us now, it's trapping them in a block of stone and successfully banishing them, and that has beneficial effects for everybody in terms of their health and well-being and for the local village. So even if it's for somebody who doesn't understand it and who just wants to take the video of it, it's actually worth doing for the local community. So they have a very kind of positive attitude to that.
Well, on that very positive note, thank you for your presentation. And I end with the idea of photographer as a kind of amuse-bouche, where you get the main course if you visit the valley. So thank you very much for that.